Welcome back. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and the Web Yeshiva with another installment in our explorations of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's Lonely Man of Faith. We are tonight looking at the personality of Adam the Second, which is the topic of the second chapter of the work. Just a quick review because we've had 2 weeks off, and I'm just looking over the list. I think I see couple of new names. If you're new, do me a favor in the chat box, just chat us a word of hello, tell us who you are and where you're from, and we'll try to make a point to get to know you. I'm muting everyone. If you'd like to speak up, please hit the raise hand button so that we can call on you and let you speak up. I'd greatly prefer that people do that. Also, I would ask you to hit the video icon next to your name so that we can see you as well. I see Alexander. You wanted to say something? You raised your hand. Hold on. Alexander, did you want to say something? You should have a microphone. Hello? Hello, Alexander, are you there? We can hear you. I will mute you again. Let me just check here. Risa is from Toronto. Gail is in Dallas. Okay, welcome to you all. Just again, quick review. Rabbi Soloveitchik takes as his point of departure the discrepancies between the tale of Genesis in chapter 1 versus that in chapter 2. The description of the creation of man differs slightly between the two chapters, picking up on four essential differences, such as, for example, in chapter 1, man and women are described, or Adam and Eve are described as being created together, and in chapter 2, it's described as a two-step process. Man is created, lo tov heyot adam levado, it is not deemed proper or good for man to dwell alone, and therefore Eve is created from his rib. But in the first chapter, they're described as Zachar and Nekevah bara otam, that they are both created. In the first chapter, man is described as being created Betzelem Elokim, in God's holy image. In the second chapter, he's described as being made from the dirt of the ground. In the first chapter, man's task seems to be the charge of Vikivshuha to overcome, to conquer the world. Whereas in the second chapter, and that's what we talked about largely last time, the how do we translate the imperative Vikivshuha to rule supremely over creation? How does Adam the First put that into practice, as opposed to Adam the Second of the second chapter, where he's tasked with la'avda u'lishamra, to guard and to work the garden, the land, the earth, the cosmos. And Rabbi Soloveitchik develops these two kind of abstract or typological characters: Adam one, Adam the first, the personality as it comes through in the first account of creation, versus that of Adam the second. Adam the first, or as he's called, majestic man, seeks to master his environment. He seeks dignity, is his hallmark, the search for dignity. Adam the Second, who we will discuss tonight, is covenantal man, who surrenders his will to God. He seeks redemption, not dignity. And that will be the topic of tonight. Next week, we'll get into chapter 3. I had suggested that you read ahead chapter 2 and 3. Chapter 3 is a discussion of how these two characters form community and what type of community each one forms. So let's get into it. Unless anybody had any questions by way of review in what we've been doing up until now. Any questions out there? Comments, thoughts? Again, please turn on your video. If you have a video, please hit the send video button. Howard, you don't have a video. Joel. Rafi. Alan, where you were all the regulars. Where are your videos? Turn them on so we can see you, please. Chapter 2 begins the description of Adam the Second. Adam the Second is, like Adam the First, also intrigued by the cosmos. The cosmos here is stand-in for the created physical natural world. It doesn't just mean the stars, although, as I mentioned, and again we'll see tonight, the essay is written in 1965, and the essay is written in 1965, and the height of the space race. And a lot of Rabbi Soloveitchik's metaphors are drawn from that. Sherry asks why I call Adam the second covenantal man. That's the description that we will encounter tonight. That's the terms that Rabbi Soloveitchik uses, and you'll see why as we move along. Intellectual curiosity drives them both to confront courageously the Mysterium Magnum. Both Adam the first and Adam the second are motivated by a kind of intellectual curiosity. And that intellectual curiosity drives them both to explore the Mysterium Magnum. I don't know how many of you studied Latin. Did anyone study Latin? Nobody? Shame on you. Well, it turns out that I studied Latin for 3 years, 2 years in high school and 1 year in Yeshiva College. And it's a worthy endeavor. Study Latin. Not that you will learn Latin, but it helps a lot in understanding English. But it also serves a little bit in trying to make head or tails of some Rabbi Soloveitchik essays. Although he also, it turns out, needs Greek. You need Greek. I'll come to that as we move along. But you can also just use Google if you didn't go to the trouble of learning Latin. Mysterium Magnum, the great mystery of being. The great mystery of the cosmos, both Adam the First and Adam the Second, are drawn by an intellectual curiosity to confront courageously. However, while the cosmos provokes Adam the First to quest for power and control, thus making him ask the functional how question, that was what we described at length, that's what we explored at length when we last met. And again, I remind you, the archives are all available, both video archives as well as for this class, MP3 audio archives. You can, from our share page, you can download the MP3 audio and listen to it on your iPod while you're on the exercise bicycle or whatever it is that you, wherever it is that you listen to your iPod. Adam the Second, however, responds to the call of the cosmos by engaging a different kind of cognitive gesture. So here's where they differ. They both confront the world. Adam the first wants to master it. He therefore asks questions, utilitarian questions, of how. Adam the second has a different motion. He does not ask a single functional question. Instead, his inquiry is of a metaphysical nature and a threefold one. So metaphysics, of course, is the study of it's sometimes used as a synonym for philosophy. It's sometimes used as a synonym for philosophy, but it's the philosophical study which can't be objectified by experience. Metaphysics, to go beyond, to transcend the physical realm. That's why for the Rambam describes physics and metaphysics, which are of course terms that are borrowed from Aristotle, or which are, if not coined by Aristotle, are adopted by Aristotle. Physics and metaphysics. Physics is the natural science, and metaphysics are the philosophical sciences. So Adam the Second's is a kind of philosophical question, and it's a threefold question at that. There are three elements or three thrusts to the question. And now Rabbi Soloveitchik gives examples. He's putting words in the mouth of Adam the Second. Number one, he wonders, why did the world in its totality come into existence? Why is man confronted by this stupendous and indifferent order of things and events? What are we doing here? Number two, he asks, what is the purpose of all of this? What is the message that is embedded in organic and inorganic matter? And what does the great challenge reaching me from beyond the fringes of the universe, as well as from the depths of my tormented soul, mean? So, why are we here? What is the purpose of creation? And what does it mean for me? How does my experience, and it's interesting that the experience of Adam the Second is described as that of a tormented soul. That's probably not by accident, but the degree to which we experience the world, our emotional experience of the world, our experiential component is a cause of question. Why are we created this way? Why are we put in a world that we can process the input, that we can enjoy the benefits, and that we can suffer on all types of levels? We can suffer if we stub our toe, which is a kind of suffering in response to a physical response, and we can suffer as the result of a broken heart, a very different type of suffering. I had the occasion to have a long conversation while I was away in this past week with someone who is troubled by the old question of, the perceived conflict between science and religion. And he made an argument, a kind of old idea, but maybe for him it was new, that only that which can be objectified exists, and anything else is it does not exist. It's a social creation. It's something that man has created in order to explain phenomena, etc., etc., etc. So I asked, well, what about love? What about envy? So he had what he thought was a trump card. He told me he's a neurologist. He could show that these are merely chemical reactions in the brain. Now, I don't know if scientifically he's correct or not, but in reality, meaning the reality, reality is not merely scientific, although the scientific reality is surely part of the component of the world in which we live. But in reality, by reality, I mean the way we organize our lives, the way we understand the experiences that we undergo. We don't think of it that way. When we experience love, or envy, or pleasure, or emotion. So I know that when I eat chocolate, you could put me into an MRI and you could show the chemical reactions in my brain. But that's not how we enjoy chocolate, or a glass of wine, or the kiss of a loved one. It's just simply not the way we experience the world. The person I was talking to may have been closer to Adam the First, minus the atheistic overtones. The person, the opinion that I was representing might be closer to Adam the Second. Number three. Yes? Correct. These are ultimately unanswerable questions, in an objective sense, but in a subjective sense, we all know how we experience the world. And that understanding of how we experience the world, if we accept the idea that there is such a thing as emotion, and emotion is something that is more than a chemical reaction or synapse firing, then on a subjective plane, that's how we feel it. It's true that Adam the Second is frustrated and has to transcend that frustration, and that is part of the loneliness of the lonely man of faith, and that is what still lies ahead of us in the coming chapters. Number three, the third question that Adam the Second asks, he keeps on wondering, who is he, capital He meaning God, who is he who trails me steadily, uninvited and unwanted, like an everlasting shadow, and vanishes into the recesses of transcendence, the very instant I turn around to confront this numinous, awesome, and mysterious he, I'm sorry, hold on one second. Somebody's having some trouble. Okay. Numinous. Numinous is a term that was coined by Rudolf Otto. Let me just get him up there. Rudolf Otto. Rudolf Otto was a late 19th, early 20th century existential philosopher and theologian, Lutheran theologian living in Germany, writing in Germany. He writes a very important book in 1917 called, in English, the English title is called The Idea of the Holy. And it is a description, the numinous, the word numinous comes from the Latin numen, which means deity or divine or God. So numinous is a kind of supernatural mystery, especially as we experience it in the presence or the perceived presence of the holy, of the godly, the kind of mystery and wonder that a person of faith, it's predicated on the notion of faith, of course, that a person of faith experiences when encountering the holy. And Otto has this book called The Idea of the Holy, where he describes this phenomena. Rabbi Soloveitchik clearly read this work and is channeling some of those ideas here. The idea that the holy, the encounter with the holy is thank you, Alan, for the link to the book. The idea that the encounter with the holy is something which is both magnetic, is it just draws us in, but at the same time frightens us, repels us. Awesome and mysterious. So Adam the Second is asking these questions about who is this God that's part of my life that I experience as part of my ongoing life. This he's scary. He's awesome. He's mysterious. Who is he who fills Adam with awe and bliss, humility and a sense of greatness concurrently? These dyads, these paradoxes, right? Awe in the sense of reverence, of like the Yomim Noraim, the days of awe. Right? Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, but also of bliss, of joy, of tranquility, humility, that we are lowly, we are nothing, but also we are majestic. We are the pinnacle of creation. Excuse me. Who is he to whom Adam clings in passionate, all-consuming love, and from he flees in mortal fear and dread? Who is he who fascinates Adam irresistibly and at the same time rejects him irrevocably? Who is he whom Adam experiences both as the Mysterium Tremendum? Here, tremendum, not from the sense of tremendous, large, not the great mystery, but the frightening mystery, terrifying mystery. Tremendum in Latin means here terrifying. And as a most elementary, most obvious, and most understandable truth. Who is he who is Deus Revelatus and Deus Absconditus? He is the God who reveals himself, as well as the God who conceals himself, absconds, hides, simultaneously. God is both around us and distant from us, far, far, far away, as well as very, very close. And we experience him, the person of faith experiences him at both levels. In other places, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his classically poetic mode, describes the sense of feeling God's gentle presence, metaphorically speaking, of course, a gentle hand on the shoulder in a time of crisis or sorrow or grief, as well as God as the Kadosh, 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 transcendent, transcendent, transcendent. He is rachok, rachok, rachok. He is far, far away. Excerpt shares, and this all from someone unlike us who had direct experiences with God. You're talking about Adam, Sherry. Yes. Oh, that's a good point. Who is he whose life-giving and life-warming breath Adam feels constantly, and who at the same time remains distant and remote from all? In order to answer this triple question, who are we? Why are we here? What does God want from us? And why do I experience him in this paradoxical way, in this dyadic way? He is both close, but he is far. I mean, we try to conjure this in some of the tefillah, in some of the prayers. The very idea of the prayer Avinu Malkeinu, that God is both our father as well as our king. I mean, fathers and kings are both stand-ins for authority figures, but they are different types of authority figures. Your father is there. He's tucking you into bed. He's tossing the bowl with you. He's very close. A king is generally very far away. Think of the Rambam's metaphor of the palace of the king in the Mor Nevuchim, that at the end of the Mor Nevuchim, that there's a palace inside the palace. Around the palace, there's a wall. Inside the palace, there's an antechamber, and then there's an inner chamber, and then there's the king's. King's private domain. Outside of the walls of the palace, there's the city. Outside of the city are the villages, and everyone is at a different holding at a different place in the quest to get to the palace. But generally speaking, the king is far away. We don't have access to him. We can't just call him. We don't have his email address. We're not friends on Facebook. Experience of God, where precisely? There's a lovely essay. Psachia asks about this reference. I'm pretty sure that I'm referring to an essay called Redemption Prayer and Talmud Torah, which is also available online. I'll send you a link, as well as in many other places where he talks about this idea of the hand on the shoulder. I'll send you a link. In order to answer this triple question, Adam the second does not apply the functional method invented by Adam the first. Remember, Adam the first is the scientist. He does not create a world of his own. Instead, he wants to understand the living, given world into which he has been cast. Therefore, he does not mathematize phenomena or conceptualize things. That was, go back to the recording if you're not sure what this is talking about from the last session. The idea of reducing the world to formulaic principles is the impulse of the scientist, is the impulse of the mathematician, is the impulse of Adam the first. Adam II encounters the universe in all of its colorfulness, splendor, and grandeur, and studies it with a naivete, awe, and admiration of the child. Naivete is not always a bad thing. Naivete sometimes allows us to see things that we overlook. I mean, those of us with children, or those of us that remember our childhood, you know, you probably are often we encounter things that, you know, children have this way of seeing right through it and getting to the truth because they're naive. They don't overlook things. Naivete in a positive sense. I mean, it's the same way as, you know, like an editor. An editor, you know, you can write something. You can write something for publication, let's say. And you, as you're writing it, you, from first draft to second draft to third draft to fourth draft to fifth draft, however many drafts, there's a typo right there. And you can't see it because you're so familiar with it that you, your eyes scan over it, and since you know what's written there, you don't catch it. You show it to an editor, boom, they find it right away because they're naive, meaning as they're reading through it, they've never read it before, right? That's why sometimes Sofrim, you know, scribes, as they are, let's say they write a mezuzah. So the mezuzah has in it Kriyat Shema, perhaps the most well-worn paragraph in the entire Torah. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. So, if they're proofreading what they've written, so it's a text which is so ingrained in them that you're liable to skip over it. We've all seen these things, you know. If you Google it, I'm sure you'll find 10 examples of, you know, try to find the typo in the following paragraph, and you know everybody misses it. Everybody misses it. So sometimes when they'll proofread, what they'll do is they'll proofread it backwards, because they know it by heart, but from beginning to end. But they don't know it by heart, end to beginning. So by proofreading it backwards against a correct text, they won't glide over a mistake without missing it. Naivete is sometimes a great, great benefit. So Adam II has that kind of childlike wonder in every ordinary thing and event. Well, Adam I is dynamic and creative, transforming sensory data into thought constructs. Adam II is receptive and beholds the world in its original dimensions. He looks for the image of God, not in the mathematical formulas or the natural relational law, but in every beam of light, in every bud and blossom, in the morning breeze and the stillness of the starlit evening. He is not the scientist, he is the poet. In a word, Adam II explores not the scientific abstract universe, but the irresistibly fascinating qualitative world where he establishes an intimate relation with God. Now, remember, just parenthetically, we're talking about two purified, distilled typological characters. They do not exist in reality, or they probably exist very rarely in reality. If you are a scientist, if you know a scientist, so the scientist is not only Adam I. The scientist also can have a sense of childlike wonder. On the contrary, you can probably pull out all those great quotes from the likes of Einstein or Edison or whomever that will prove that the scientist, a good scientist, needs some of that. But a real scientist in the real world is not a typology. He's a complex, real human being. So he's going to contain elements of different personalities that have been merged together, that exist, that exist together. The biblical metaphor referring to God breathing life into Adam alludes to the actual preoccupation of the latter with God. So that's the description. That's the description of how Adam the Second is created. V'yipach ba'apav nishmat chayim v'yihi Adam le'nefesh chaya. That God takes man, forms him from the lowly matter, and then breathes life into him. It's a very intimate description. It's a very close kind of connection. So that biblical metaphor, and it's interesting, of course, to note that Rabbi Soloveitchik refers to whatever that means, God blowing life into the nostrils of man, as a metaphor. It is not a literal description. And it's always important to remember that we are not and never have read the Bible in a literal tradition, but we believe in an interpretive tradition, and we believe in metaphor. That is, after all, the opening great theme of the Rambam's Mora Nevuchim, of the Guide to the Perplexed, the use of language, the meaning of language, the use of metaphor. So that metaphor, referring to God breathing life into Adam, alludes to the actual preoccupation of the latter with God, to his genuine living experience of God, rather than to some divine potential or endowment in Adam symbolized by imago Dei, the image of God, the Tselem Elokim. Tselem Elokim, God being created, but Tselem Elokim is the description of Adam the first. The description of man being, what did I say? I'm sorry, I made a mistake. The description of man being created, but Tselem Elokim, in the image of God, imago Dei, is the description of Adam the first. Adam the second is a more modest description, but yet a more intimate one in terms of the creation of a relationship between man and God. Adam the second lives in close union with God. His existential I experiences interwoven in the awareness of communing with the great self, whose footprint he discovers along the many torturous paths of creation. Again, torturous, suffering. Go ahead, we're on page 23 in our edition of the essay. I stated previously that both atoms are equally provoked by the mystery of being, even though the methods they employ in their heroic attempt to come to terms and to arrange a modus vivendi with the mysterium magnum are incongruous. Meaning Adam the first and Adam the second both start off with the same question or the same stimulus, gazing out in wonder at the world. But they attempt to arrive at their answers with different they go about it in different ways, different modus vivendi, a way of going about it. Let me add now that not only the etiological. Now, you know, I'm going to skip ahead a drop. Both atoms want to be human. Both strive to be themselves, to be what God commanded them to be, namely man. Both of them want to understand themselves and their place in the world, but they go about it in different ways. The incongruity of methods is, therefore, a result not of diverse objectives, but of diverse interpretive approaches to the one objective they both pursue. Right? Different paths to the same goal. The two atoms do not concur in their interpretation of this objective. The idea of humanity, the great challenge summoning man to action and movement, is placed by them in two incommensurate perspectives. While Adam the first wants to redeem himself, I'm sorry, wants to reclaim himself from a closed-in, non-reflective, natural existence by setting himself as a dignified, majestic being capable of ruling his environment, Adam the second sees his separateness from nature and his existential uniqueness not in dignity or majesty, but in something else. Adam the first, majestic man, seeks dignity. the way to overcome your position in the world is through the acquisition of dignity. Adam II is searching for something else. He is searching for redemption. There is, in his opinion, in Adam II's opinion, another mode of existence through which man can find his own self, namely the redemptive, which is not necessarily identical with the dignified. Quite often, an existence might be replete with dignity and mastery, and yet remain unredeemed. An atheist cosmonaut circling the earth, advising his superiors who placed him in orbit that he did not encounter any angels, might lay claim to a dignity of a sort, because he courageously mastered space. He is, however, very far from experience a redeemed existence. Here, again, another space metaphor. Yuri Gagarin, first Soviet cosmonaut, goes up in 1961, and according to the Apocrypha, according to the legend, he was reported to have said, I don't see any God up here. Rabbi Soloveitchik alters the quote a little bit. Apparently, the quote was, not angels, but I don't see any God up here in space. So therefore, of course, there is no God, proof of the Soviet claim. Apparently, this is an urban legend. Apparently, Yuri Gagarin himself was baptized in the Russian Orthodox Church, but also had his children baptized or his daughter baptized or something like that. He was a closeted man of faith, and apparently this was a quote by none other than Khrushchev, but for propaganda purposes, it was used. But that's just a footnote in the story. Rabbi Soloveitchik's point is not lost, that a case like this is a sign of dignity. It's a sign of man conquering the elements. Let's not forget what it meant when they sent the first man up to space, what it meant for the self-image of the United States. But yet there is no redemption. Psst. In order to delineate more sharply the contours of Adam II, who rejected dignity as the sole objective of human questioning, who rejects this notion of vikivshuha, that we have to master the world, and that mastery lends dignity, lends respect, self-respect. Let us add the following observation. And now Rabbi Soloveitchik expands upon this idea of what dignity is and what the sources of dignity are. He makes the point that dignity is a social and behavioral category, expressing not an intrinsic quality, an intrinsic existential quality, but a technique of living. Meaning dignity only has, there's no dignity in a desert island. There's no kavod for Robinson Crusoe, living in isolation. It's all a social construct. The know-how of commanding respect and attention of the other fellow, a capacity to make one's presence felt. In Hebrew, the noun kavod, dignity, and the noun koved, weight or gravitas, stem from the same root. The man of dignity is a weighty person. Figure of speech. The people who surround him feel his impact. Hence, dignity is measured not by the inner worth of the in-depth personality, but by the accomplishments of the surface personality. No, I mean, which is not meant to say that we are not meant to evaluate a person's true worth for their inner character. He's describing not the ideal, but a kind of reality, a way that society generally organizes itself. No matter how fine, noble, and gifted one may be, he cannot command respect or be appreciated by others if he has not succeeded in realizing his talents and communicating his message to society through the medium of creative and majestic gesture. I'm going to skip ahead again. And that's why, precisely, Adam the First was created not alone, but together with Eve. We're on the bottom of page 25. In the description of creation, Adam the First, Zachar u'Nekeva, bara otam. Man and women are created together, simultaneously. Only Adam the Second is described as being created in isolation, followed by the subsequent creation of Eve, because it's not good for man to be alone. So Adam the First is created, male and female emerge simultaneously. Adam the First exists in society, in community with others. From the beginning, embedded in man's creation is community. By community, we mean one human being living in interaction and in harmony with another human being. And this gets into the idea of community and the different types of community that each will form, which will be the topic of the next chapter. Adam the First is a social being, gregarious, communicative, emphasizing the artistic aspects in life and giving priority to form over content, to literary expression over the eidos. Eidos is a Greek word. It means the kind of distinct expression of the cognitive or intellectual character of a society, to practical accomplishment over inner motivation. He is blessed with the gift of rhetoric. Rhetoric, speech, communication, the grease on the wheels of society, the manner in which people can interact and communicate, the faculty of communication, be it the beautiful word or the efficacious machine, the socially acceptable ethic etiquette or the hush of the solemn memorial assembly, the visible perceptible image, perceptible public image of the personality is fraught with majesty and dignity. But majesty and dignity are, again, socially constructed. They only have meaning for someone when he is in the midst of a community. Adam the First is never alone. Man in solitude has no opportunity to display his dignity and majesty, since both are behavioral social traits. Adam the First was not left alone even on the day of creation. Even from the first moment of creation, there's never a moment where there's only one human in the world. He is created with his twin, with his wife. He emerged into the world together with Eve, and God addressed himself to both of them as inseparable members of one community. Let me take a look here at the chat. And that's the end of chapter two here. But let me just look. These chats are coming in. Hold on. Yeah, Sherry, I think you picked up on this point of the breath of God. And then I hope that became clear as we moved along, that is the distinct, that is the distinct character of Adam the Second. Renato asks, what does it mean here to be redeemed? Is it to resolve the existential anguish faced by Adam the Second? But if Adam One does not perceive these problems, how can he be said to be redeemed or not from them? Well, correct. In other words, Adam the First is not seeking redemption. Adam the Second, who feels the anguish, who feels the torment, searches for a way out of that. That is the redemption. Here, it's important to note that here we're talking about redemption. Don't be confused, A, by the colloquial Christian overtones that are sometimes associated with the term redemption, and don't even be misled by some of the Jewish overtones of the phrase redemption, which are caught up with messianic elements. That's not what we're talking about here. Here we're talking about a way out of the loneliness, the suffering. Could that be the explanation of in our image? Well, I'm not sure, Sherry. That's an interesting point. Sherry asks a question when it says, "Bitzalmenu." When God describes the creation of man, Naseh Adam Betzalmenu, in our image, which Rashi describes as a kind of the God talking in the royal we. But maybe since God himself is neither masculine nor feminine, then when Adam the first is created, not Adam the first, but Adam the first is really Adam slash Eve the first. Maybe that's an interesting idea. That's an interesting idea. Alexander. Alexander posted something to me privately. Alexander, if you want to post it to everyone, just cut and paste it back in. And where it says send to, make sure it says send to everyone. But I will post it for you, and then I will address it. Hi, can you hear? Are you out there? Okay, we're back. So you see, Alexander makes the following point. People go back and forth between Adam the first and Adam the second during their lives. Yes, that's true. And again, we're not talking about actual people, but these kind of reduced typologies, these kind of abstract or pure, as if we could put a human personality into a centrifuge and distill it out into its disparate forms. In reality, we of course are both. Rabbi Soloveitchik is not passing judgment. He's not saying one is good and the other isn't good, or one is better than the other. And in reality, we possess both of them. That will be addressed a little bit more as we move along. But you ask, Alexander, is there a tendency for people to be drawn more towards Adam the second as they get older? And more humble about their ability to conquer the world with Adam the first. That's interesting. What do people think about? I'm curious. What do people think about that? Is humility a feature of Adam the second? And is that something that we in the real world come to through experience and through growing older and people think? No, certainly people don't. Humility doesn't happen automatically, that's for sure. And there are plenty of young people that are humble, but sometimes humility is something that comes through experience. And I wonder if there isn't something to that, that Adam the second represents a type of maturity, refinement that in some ways is lacking in Adam the first, despite Adam the first's many important good qualities. Rabbi Soloveitchik clearly admires him. I sent a link to an essay by Rabbi Walter Wurzberger about the centrality of creativity in Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought, and that is talking about Adam the first, not explicitly but implicitly. That is the characteristic of Adam the first, the creative impulse, which is something that Rabbi Soloveitchik greatly admires. So that's evidence of the fact that we're not passing judgment on one or the other. We're trying to get to the archetypes here to understand both of them. Well, Psachi, in other words, Adam the first and Adam the second, is Adam the first is the description that emanates from chapter 1 of Genesis, And Adam the second is the description that emanates from chapter 2 of Genesis. So why one came before the other, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that Rabbi Soloveitchik addressed that question. In other words, conceivably, the description of Adam the second might have come in the first chapter. We might have switched the chapters, meaning we could conceive of a parallel universe in which God would have given a Torah, where the description of Adam the second precedes that of Adam the first. Why it goes this way is an interesting question. We'll have to think about that. No, it's not older. It's two parallel descriptions. These are two, again, to be clear, these are two parallel descriptions of creation. Creation only happens once. It's described the first time in chapter one. It's described the second time in chapter two, and there are discrepancies between them. It's like, what's that? What's that? There's that very famous Japanese film, perhaps the most famous Japanese film of all time, because it's the only Japanese film I've ever seen. Rashomon, correct, Rashomon, which is a description of a certain incident. I think there are only three characters in the film, a husband, a wife, and like a bandit. And the story is told three times from each of their perspectives. They're all true, but since they're told from different perspectives, the emphases are different. And it's if you Google Rashomon, Sherry put it up in the thing, the term Rashomon, I don't recall what the Japanese word Rashomon means, but that term, the title of that film, has become synonymous with this idea of multiple tellings of something round out the whole of the experience, and that's the difference between chapter one and chapter two. They're both describing the creation of man, but from different perspectives, as it were. Aren't Adam 1 and Adam 2 the resistance to each other that allows? Reese, what do you mean, the tension between the two? What do you mean by the resistance to each other? Yes, correct. In other words, this is, the idea of thesis, antithesis, synthesis of the Hegelian notion of the two working against. Oh, I see you're trying to put it into the context of husband and wife, which is, again, interesting. I think that's part of what Sherry was getting at. I think that's part of what Sherry was getting at. But yeah, but they, again, Lahavdil, the yin and the yang. Two working against each other, since each of us contains both of these personalities, that tension becomes a, can become, it can be stifling, but it can also become a source of creativity. It can become a source of redemption, and that is what we will talk about as we move along. No, I think Renato, I think you're correct, and I also thought of that it's true that there seems that he seems to be giving a different angle on what dignity means, but it's possible to read the definition of dignity of chapter two, even back into chapter one. the ability to gain dignity by gaining mastery of the world has something to do with the esteem one is held in by having accomplished that. There's a commercial component to it, that invention, creativity has value partially in relation to the price tag that we're prepared to put on it. That's why Adam the First is not so interested in the aesthetic component of things, but in the utilitarian component. Artistic creation has value, but of a different type. Even though if you paint, if Rembrandt paints a painting and you put it away for 300 years, it's going to have a price tag on it. But aesthetic, for the sake of aesthetic alone, does not have a commercial component to it. Whereas inventing a supersonic jet does have, inventing the wheel does have. So it could be that I assume that these are connected ideas. Alexander, again, when you send a chat, there's a box that says send to, and then there's a drop-down box. If it's set to send to everyone, then it goes to everyone. If not, it goes directly to whoever you're sending to. If you're having trouble, please contact tech support. Maybe. All good comments, but we'll have to call it an end to it here. I am very happy, of course, to hear your thoughts on all this as we move along. You can email me during the week. Here's my email in the chat. Here's the email in the chat. And again, I would really, really, really implore you all to please get webcams. Get a webcam, turn on your webcam so we can all see you, and that will enhance the experience for us all. Just looking through the list here. Okay.